This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
You're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashran Johan. The government of Malaysia will be launching the Progressive Wage Policy Voluntary Pilot Program in June. The policy draws from Singapore's progressive wage model, albeit with some key differences. But what are these key differences and what can Malaysia learn from the successes and flaws of the Singapore model? Kelvin Cheng and Kevin Zhang are two public policy researchers who recently wrote a paper for the Institute of Strategic and International Studies, ISIS, titled Malaysia's Progressive Wage, A Guide to Policy Design Considerations for Effective Implementation, which is what we're going to be unpacking on today's episode. As always, this conversation is also available as podcasts. You can look up Beyond the Ballot Box on Spotify, the BFM app, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Kevin, Kelvin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the progressive wage model or the progressive wage policy, right? It's an effort by the Ministry of Economy of Malaysia to improve wages in this country. Now, before we talk about that, give me an overview of the wage situation in Malaysia. How do we analyze it? How do we benchmark it compared to regional labors like Singapore, Vietnam, Australia, China, South Korea? How's Malaysia doing on the wage front?
It is definitely important to set the context for Malaysia before going on to a deeper discussion. So we all know that Australia has one of the highest wage in the world, not just for Asia Pacific. Their minimum wage is like probably 20 Aussie dollar per hour, which is way off the chart, even compared to Singapore. So probably can leave them out for now. So for Malaysia-wise, there has been probably a slight decline during the COVID pandemic. But if you actually see the numbers before that, so in 2019, the median Malaysian employee salary was at 2,500. So that's about, if you look at it just in terms of absolute figures, why Singapore is about 4,500 Singapore dollars. So if you compare Malaysia converted to SGD, it's about only 800. So that's probably only around 20% of Singapore's median wage, right? Compared to Vietnam, Malaysia has a slightly higher minimum wage law for compared to Vietnam, but then again, Vietnam wages has been increasingly steady over the last decade or so, which unlike Malaysia, which has been relatively there has been progress, yeah. But the thing is that because of inflation, real wage growth hasn't been very impressive for Malaysia.
This is quite an interesting question for me because it's something I'm still in the process of crunching the numbers on, because you know comparing like the wages across different countries is it's not very straightforward, right? So for example, different countries have different currencies and then different price levels for goods and services and then also different rates of participation and so on and so forth. But in my preliminary analysis of the data that I currently have, I'd like to have add a few points to that. And it's quite interesting and perhaps perhaps a bit contrarian as well, or I don't know, depending on your opinion. So based on my preliminary analysis, in comparing observed monthly wages, this is on average national level across countries, right? The data suggests that Malaysia's wages are actually not low for its level of development or level of income, right? Nor has wage growth been uncharacteristically slow in the last decade, at least in the last decade, compared to the global average. So let me be a little bit more specific, right? The data suggests that Malaysia's real wage growth is slightly above global averages, about 2-3% per annum in most years over the past decade or so. And Malaysia's wages level, the level of wages, appear to be in line for its level of development and level of income, at least based on 2022 data that's adjusted based on purchasing power parity terms. That means that we adjust for exchange rates to account for different price levels in each country. So once we do that, we see that Malaysia's wages are quite in line with what is expected for our level of income. So in that sense, the main limiting factor for wages in that sense is a higher GNI per capita growth or higher labor productivity growth. And that's maybe one of the other issues, right? So if we're talking about comparatively as well, again, in the PPP terms, we adjust for the cost of living in different countries, right? So wages in Malaysia on aggregate are about half of that of Korea, South Korea, Australia, and Singapore. But keep in mind, the gross national income of these countries are about four times higher than Malaysia, right? I think we compare on the flip side to countries like China, Thailand, Malaysia's wages on average nationally are about 1.5 to 1.7 times those countries. So it's quite interesting looking at this like cross-country dynamics, I would say.
How would you respond to arguments by labor rights activists that over the past several decades, our GDP has gone up by about 24 times? But when we look at the wage of a factory worker, for example, have only gone up like 1.4 times. You know, so the country's GDP over the past 2 to 3, 4 decades, especially compared since the 70s, have risen up exponentially. But the wages have stagnated or at least not risen on par with the overall growth of the country. How do you respond to that?
That's a very interesting and, I guess, complex type of question. I mean, first off, I want to say that I agree with a lot of the points brought up by labor activists. I'm definitely more on the side of the fact that we need to have stronger worker bargaining power over employers, and that over the decades, traditionally and typically, there are very important social, political, and historical reasons why worker bargaining power in Malaysia has been sort of unbalanced in favor of employers. Right? I guess the first thing to be clear is that I am in agreement with all of that. And I think part of the dissonance between what I just mentioned and the facts that these activists have brought up is the fact that one point is perhaps that a lot of the progress in wage growth has been made quite recently, right? So a lot of the progress in terms of improving labor market institutions, so the minimum wage is going to come in like 2013. And a lot of the amendments in labor legislation has only been in place since like 2017. And there's some that even more recent than that. Last year, for example, a lot of these things take time to work through the system to get to the outcomes that we want to see, right? So I guess all is to say that a lot of the progress is relatively recent. And if you take a multi-decade view, then yes, of course, we can see that a lot of these things are still out of balance. And I guess another aspect is that could potentially explain this dissonance is wage dispersion, right? Or rather, what we call wage inequality. For example, so I'm looking, the data that I quoted was looking at the average wage, for example, but perhaps a wage for a factory worker, for instance, could reflect larger trends in increasing wage dispersion or increasing wage inequality in the Malaysian labor market.
So let's talk about one of those interventions that Malaysia is planning. As of right now, as Kelvin, you mentioned, we have a minimum wage law. The government is now pushing to do a progressive wage model or progressive wage policy. One of the countries in the world that has a progressive wage model is Singapore. How would y'all compare and contrast the design of Singapore's progressive wage model to Malaysia's, or at least whatever the government has proposed and put out right now?
Yeah, so it's interesting because Malaysia's progressive wage policy is very similar borrowing. In fact, Rafizi mentioned that it's actually draw inspiration from Singapore. But I would say that to some extent it's a misnomer because there are crucial policy differences between both countries, mm-hmm. notwithstanding the differences. So some of the first thing is that Malaysia's progressive wage, PWP, is actually a voluntary policy covering all sectors as long as it is covering micro and medium-sized entrepreneurs and for people earning below a certain income. Whereas in Singapore, progressive wage progressive wage model rather, covers only very limited specific sectors which are low income. So basically the sectors which are the lowest income earning in Singapore, security guards, cleaners, landscapers, recently they extended to even cashiers. So Singapore progressive wage is a lot more targeted compared to Malaysia, whereas a lot Malaysia is just like what right across the board. And because of this, it also implements a lot of it creates a lot of differences in terms of whether there's a minimum wage setting, whether there is government kind of support, whether how much accreditation and certification goes on, yeah, and so on and so forth, because of this crucial policy differences.
Could you paint a picture for me? Let's say I joined today as a security guard in a security company. How much is my starting pay in 2024, broadly? How much is it going to be? And how will it increase over time because of the progressive wage model?
Unlike Malaysia, Singapore has a very sectoral-based approach towards progressive wage. And each of the sector, there's actually clear career ladders for people to progress upwards. And of course, with each ladder, there's a corresponding wage increase or minimum wage for each particular ladder. And this is mandatory for all firms who are operating in this industry. So for example, in security sector, people start off as a, you know, the title is called security officer with a salary of at least 2.6 thousand Singapore dollars. And there is actually qualification required. So there's two basic licensing units and they have to recognize terror threats. So subsequently, with 18 months, minimum of 18 months experience with four more advanced modules, they can move up to senior security officer, which is 2.9 thousand. And progressing which security supervisor, $300 extra, moving on to senior security supervisor. And for each of this ladder, there is a timeline for in terms of experience required and also additional courses for the people to attend before they can be certified as to qualify as an HTA. So what I have to specify this is that it is not guaranteed, and this is what I have talking to people on the ground, is that it's not guaranteed that when you meet the timeline and the modules required in terms of certification, it's not guaranteed that people will move up the ladder. A lot of it also depends on the company's demand, whether there is such actual demands. And from what I understand, there's a lot of hiring shortages at the lower level, for example, at the security officer. But when you move on to senior security supervisor, which with a starting salary of at least 3.5K, there isn't really such demand. So you have many people who are in that sense overqualified for the role, but earning a much lower pay, at least based on this progressive wage ladder scheme.
So this is in Singapore. How, based on the information that we have right now, the white paper that was released by Rafizi Ramli, how would it work in a Malaysian setting?
Yeah, so I think it's important to recognize that the white paper by Rafizi has pointed out that Malaysia is starting a trial, and after the trial, there will likely be adjustments, tweaks to it. So we shouldn't take the white paper as the final policy document of Malaysia. It's really not fair to Rafizi. And the current thing is that under the current Malaysian white paper, there is a commitment for workers to attend mandatory training courses in order for them to qualify, but there is no career ladder simply because there is no targeted occupations or industries. Basically, you know, it covers the whole entire country, and it's probably unlikely for them to, at least at this current stage, to think of an exact ladder per se. Plus, there is also a lack of specific details about what kind of courses people have to attend. And the number of modules they work, number of years experience, these are all not mentioned in the white paper, except for a brief statement that they will have to attend mandatory courses in order to get the incentive.
So what do you make of the Ministry of Economy's decision to make participation in the Malaysian progressive wage model voluntary? At least that's what it is for now. Because from my understanding, when we, you know, what you just said about Singapore's model, in Singapore's model is mandatory. And even that, right, it cannot necessarily guarantee that there's going to be a wage increase. Or at least, you know, you go for upskilling, but that doesn't mean there is a job waiting for you. So there are certain flaws with the Singapore's model as well. Kevin, could you tell me why Singapore opted for the mandatory method instead of the voluntary method, and what do you think of the voluntary method that Malaysia is going for?
You know, both countries have very different contexts because the time period where the progressive wage was launched was very different. So Singapore launched progressive wage a few years after the global financial crisis in 2008. And we know that in the lead up to 2000 financial crisis, there has been wage dispersion, as mentioned by Kelvin a moment ago. So the median wage in Singapore was increasing by about, I think, 3 or 4% per annum leading up to 2008. For the higher tier income earners, there was even faster growth. But for people at the, let's call them the B20 or B40 Malaysian context, there was negligible or even almost a slight decline in real wage growth in the years leading up to the financial crisis. So there was a serious problem with wage dispersion. And of course, with the global financial crisis, you know, median wage decline, but people on the ground, you know, in terms of their salaries did not increase. So the government had to do something to prevent this problem of outsourcing, which is hurting the low-income earners. But what they did is that before the progressive wage was launched, they tried to do just try to encourage firms to pay more for their low income workers, be it through moral suasion, through advertisements, public campaigns, but all this didn't really bring out to fruition. So which is why the government in early 2010s launched the progressive wage. But it started out only for the cleaning industry. And even then, it wasn't mandatory for all firms to comply. Mm-hmm. They had a long kind of a transition period before that it became mandatory. And when it started out, I believe the amount was $800 for cleaners. Yeah.
Kelvin, I want to get your thoughts on this as well. Mm-hmm. How are you reading this voluntary approach to the progressive wage model? What are the short-term, long-term implications? Because this seems to be, I think, that one area where I'm personally not very convinced myself. And there seems to be some pushback by labor rights groups as well, who all welcome, broad as a concept, a progressive wage model. We need wages to go up. Wages for all sectors from the bottom, also the middle class and all of that, right? Mm-hmm. But do you think this voluntary method will work?
Right. So in our policy brief, we try to take a perspective where there are a lot of policy design choices that policymakers can take, and there are trade-offs to each of them. And then we also highlight some ways in which we think we can go forward. But I guess specifically on this mandatory point, I think there's a difference if it's voluntary currently for purposes of the pilot, purposes of the trial. As Kevin mentioned earlier, this is just a trial phase where we're learning things, we're trying to refine the policy design, and that is okay for now. But if we're talking about longer term, like if it will be voluntarily pretty much forever, then there will be some trade-offs and some impacts involved in terms of inclusivity, in terms of its ability to really drive wage growth and productivity growth and skills development, all the things that we really want, right? So I guess in the short term, it makes sense to have it voluntarily for now, right? So, firstly, it's easier institutionally and in terms of administrative capacity for policymakers to administer. It's much easier if it's voluntary, then you don't have to do all these things like enforce compliance. You don't have to do all these things like check who's complying, who's not. And it's also easier for firms. So over the past few quarters, we've seen small and medium enterprises in general having some tough time adjusting to various different new policy changes that have been in place over across the board, right? And that includes the minimum wage, includes compliance requirements for ESG and so on and so forth. So a voluntary system makes it less disruptive for these firms. And it's kind of a pressure management thing, right? Where it puts less pressure on many of the businesses that we aim to help in that sense. But in the longer term, like I said, a voluntary approach permanently will limit the wage and productivity impacts of this policy potentially, right? So one reason is just because there's less participation. So there's less change actors in terms of the amount of units of firms and workers that this policy will affect. So in that sense, it will sort of limit the sort of impacts that it can have.
On the show with me today is Kevin Zhang and Kelvin Cheng, public policy researchers. We will be back with more after the break. Keep it here on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Darshan Johan, and on the show with me today is Kevin Zhang and Kelvin Cheng, public policy researchers. And we're comparing and contrasting the Singapore progressive wage model with the one proposed by the Malaysian government as we approach the launch of the pilot program here in Malaysia. This conversation will also be available on podcasts. You can look up Beyond the Ballot Box on Spotify, the BFM app, or wherever you get your podcasts from. If you are listening to this on Spotify, do give us a follow, drop us a review. It would be really, really helpful. So, in your research, you say that the proposed progressive wage model will leave out most workers in Malaysia. Why do you say so?
We look at the eligibility conditions of the current progressive wage model as outlined in the white paper. And again, this might change in the future, but for now, this is what we're working with, right? So according to the white paper, the progressive wage model will only target micro, small, and medium enterprises, or MSMEs, right? And MSMEs collectively, based on quite recent data, they employ about 50% of the country's workforce. So in that sense, just from that one condition alone, you've sort of removed half of Malaysian workers from that equation, right? And then you further add in the other eligibility conditions. And that includes like the Malaysia's progressive wage policy only affecting full-time workers. And of those full-time workers, only if you are a contract worker, you need to have a contract off service, or you have a contract for service, which is a different thing. You need to have a contract for service above 3 years, right? So you add all of that in, and that further more and more progressively cuts down the amount of workers that you cover. So we estimate that altogether, that would probably cut that down to like less than 31% of workers, for example.
Right.
Even though the white paper mentions that 2/3 of the Malaysian workforce falls below the 5,000 maximum participation threshold, which is true, but that doesn't account for all the other eligibility conditions that are in the current model design.
And does the progressive wage model cover migrant workers, or is it for Malaysians specifically?
I think the white paper, Kevin can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the white paper mentions that it's for Malaysians only.
Yes.
And that's similar to the Singapore model.
Which is the Singapore to the Singapore one, which Singapore covers Singaporeans and permanent residents, but they leave out the bulk migrant workers.
Right. So what is the impact of this lack of inclusivity in Malaysia's progressive wage model? And also something else that popped into mind when Kelvin was talking about how the progressive wage model in Malaysia is primarily, it taps into MSMEs, the big multinational corporations, your conglomerates, they are all not going to be falling under the progressive wage model. Obviously, you're not the minister, but from your analysis, what could be the potential reasons for choosing those, as MSMEs specifically, and not targeting these larger conglomerates, these multinational corporations, and so on and so forth? How do you see that, and what's the impact of the lack of inclusivity in Malaysia's progressive wage model?
I'll target your second question first, which is why there was this, well, at least from the government's point of view, why did they not cover the MNCs or large corporations, or for the matter even the JLCs?
Mm-hmm.
The based on the statistics figures which provided by Dawson Malaysia, the highest medium wage occurs for the MNECs and JLCs, subsequently followed by the medium enterprise, subsequently followed by small enterprise, and the lowest medium wage happens at the micro enterprise level, which are firms with below 5 persons, which at a macro level makes sense, because generally the smaller firms, they lack the economies of scale, they have very thin profit margins, and therefore they might have less appetite to increase their wages. Particularly since minimum wage was just adjusted from 2002 to 2005 in 2022, so many of the micro and even medium enterprise are still adjusting to this huge minimum wage hike. But what I think is important to recognize is that this is only at the macro medium wage level, right? So if you look at even the large MNCs, there are many people who are doing, for example, people who are actual employees of a manufacturing firm, which is a large MNCs, they could still be doing low pay jobs, for example, on the assembly line, which means that their salary in practice is not going to be a lot more different compared to people in the MNC, because they are doing the same job at the end of the day. Maybe they get a bit more benefits, but it's probably not going to be a lot of differences. So personally, I think that this segmentation based on firm size is a bit strange. Because if you look at the Singapore model, the segmentation is done based on occupation rather than how big or how small, for example, cleaning firm or security firm is. Because if people are doing the same job, then why do you want to split them out based on how big or small the firm is, right? That's not really their fault of their own. There's nothing much they can do for that. Yeah. For a second question on whether there's a lack of inclusivity, I would say that definitely living out foreign workers makes the policy a lot less inclusive, because Malaysia has a really large for the migrant force, about 2 to 4 million. But that's also because so what Rafizi did mention is that they are also facing financial constraints, and therefore they really want to make sure that every dollar towards this policy goes towards maximizing, you know, Malaysians' income. And because they only allocated between, I think, 3 to 5 billion, depending on what scenario they take. But, you know, it's not going to be more than 5 billion a year in terms of allocation. So there's funding cuts for that. And the last point is that because Malaysia, for Malaysia, migrant workers are actually covered the minimum wage laws of 1.5. So at least migrant workers have some protection, whereas in Singapore, because there is no minimum wage, so therefore foreign workers do not even have a basic wage floor. So in that sense, the minimum wage sort of take care of foreign workers to some extent in Malaysia.
Right. Kelvin, what do you think of that, right? This idea that in Singapore, there is no minimum wage law. There is the progressive wage model. You know, oftentimes people would say maybe pick one or the other. But in Malaysia, what it seems is like it's going to be, you know, moving together in tandem. So the argument on why the progressive wage model is not going to be, you know, maybe covering migrant workers, big companies, so on and so forth, is that the minimum wage law will plug the gaps. So the minimum wage law is inclusive. Everyone who works here gets paid a particular baseline at minimum. In fact, they are thinking of, the government has announced that they will be revising the minimum wage this year. So many people are pushing from it to increase from 1,005 to 2,000 ringgit. And then the progressive wage model is implemented on top of the minimum wage. Could the progressive wage model then be seen as something policy created to target or to break through from the middle income trap? So it's more for low paid white collar workers, professionals on the lower tier who are earning, let's say, 3,500 ringgit, for example, 4,000 ringgit, and they can't seem to break through that middle income trap. Do you think that's what is being tried to achieve here, where the minimum wage is the minimum wage, it plugs the gaps, the progressive wage is to break through the middle income trap? How do you see that?
I think that's an interesting way to look at it. And I think that sentiment would be broadly correct in the sense that these are two different policies, especially in the Malaysian institutional context. These are two different policies with two different goals, right? So the minimum wage is a mandatory wage floor. And that helps to put a floor in the sense that, you know, employers cannot outcompete each other to, you know, go be below that floor. And that obviously has benefits for worker welfare, for wages, so on and so forth. And the progressive wage model has a different goal, right? Its goal is to increase not just the wage floor, but the wage growth, right? So that increases to increase productivity, to increase skills development. That's why there's all this talk about the skill development ecosystem and courses and stuff. So inherently, in my view, there are two different things, and they can work in tandem on top of each other. And one thing that we outline in the paper is that we should be careful not to leave out the progressive minimum wage in other labor standards, in other market institutions like the minimum wage. We should not choose the progressive wage model over the minimum wage. In fact, they should both work together, and we should continue to, obviously there's the National Wage Consultative Council, which mandates every 2 years we need to at least review the minimum wage, right? It doesn't have to go up, but it has to be reviewed. And there are other issues with the minimum wage, including the national implementation and so on and so forth. But all this is to say that they are two separate things and they can both work together. And we should continue to look at them as two parts of a whole.
What do y'all make of the incentive / subsidy aspect of the progressive wage model? The government will be subsidizing, as Kevin brought it up just a second ago, the government will be subsidizing firms. The government will be spending up to $5 billion a year. Does the Singapore government subsidize firms and companies? And some might ask, why subsidize? Why not just force employers to fork out more for wages?
At the theoretical level, people do see progressive wage in Malaysia as different from minimum wage because, you know, it's more for like what you call it, is stagnant white collar workers who are stuck with maybe 3,000 ringgit. They want to go up to 4,000. So at the theoretical level, that makes sense. They are targeting different segments compared to minimum wage. But the point is that if you look at the actual incentive offered by the government, it is, I think it was 200 for fresh hires and or entry-level jobs and 300 for middle-level jobs, right? So what this would in turn be on the ground is that only employers who are hiring people on this lower wage, probably blue-collar jobs, will be more likely to take up this kind of government incentive. Because if a person is getting 1.8 or 2,000 ringgit, then this $300 or $400 extra plus what the employers are paid would incentivize them to take out the policy-wise. But if the person are getting like 4,000, then I don't think this amount would be sufficient to incentivize firms to increase their workers kind of to move up the kind of white-collar middle-class ladder. So this policy in practice is going to overlap a lot with minimum wage by targeting a lot of the, maybe the B40, less of the M40. But to your second question about Singapore, so when the progressive wage policy was first, progressive wage model, sorry, was first launched in Singapore, like what you said, the government did not provide any subsidy. It was seen as basically we tried moral suasion, that didn't work. So employers now have the responsibility to stop outsourcing. We started out, and there was no incentive given. Firms just had to comply. If not, they had to price out the market after the voluntary phase was phased out. But what happened is that over the last, especially since the pandemic, the government has been expanding progressive wage to many other occupations. For now, even drivers, clerks, office administrators, cashiers. And when the government expanded this to a lot more sectors, the government actually implemented progressive wage transition subsidy. So on the first year, they get about, I think it was, 70% of the wage increase, second year 50%, third year 30%. So that's something that the government has been aware, because when you roll out on a wider level, when you just expand beyond just a cleaning or security to like so many other professions, you definitely need to provide a lot more of help for firms, because the impact's a lot larger on society, right? And the cost of living will have an impact without subsidies.
One thing to note, one small I guess the systematic thing is like the subsidy is, we can think of it as subsidy. It's not really subsidy for training, right? It's more like we're subsidizing a part of the wage increase. And mm-hmm. part of the requirements is that, of course, you have to fulfill a training requirement, so on and so forth, that is outlined under the white paper. And the Singapore model, as Kevin mentioned earlier, it's a similar thing, but it's sort of a, the way they frame it, it's a co-funding model, right? So as Kevin mentioned earlier, about 70% of the gross monthly wage increase for the first 2 years will be borne by the government, and then it decreases in the subsequent years. So I think the idea is that wage growth is something that we are aiming towards, right? We're aiming towards higher wages. But market forces alone cannot bring the kind of wage outcomes that society wants, perhaps. So in that sense, government intervention steps in to sort of co-fund the extra little bit that we need to meet our goals.
How should the progressive wage model or policy work within the existing skills training ecosystem in Malaysia? Because in Malaysia, we often talk about how there is a mismatch in qualification with job market availability. A lot of people are overqualified for certain jobs, or they get qualifications in certain jobs and then the jobs don't exist. We know people with, they have masters in bioscience, and then in Malaysia, there's just no industry or not much or not developed that people get around 1,800 ringgit, and this is master's holders. So when we have a progressive wage model and then we say people are going to be upskilling, do we have the ecosystem, or are there a lot of other areas that need to be fixed and improved so that the progressive wage policy can work properly in the first place?
I think the bioscience example you gave is basically quite apt, but at the same time, that's education, right? And now, I guess in a progressive wage policy, we're looking at post-education in terms of workers that are already in the labor market and in training, right? So I think the white paper does not specifically detail how the progressive wage policy will be integrated with the existing skills training ecosystem. or basically even how it will interact with existing educational pathways or existing activism market policies. But we have all these things in place, but we just don't know how they will link. But right. we do think, and we outline this paper, that strengthening these links to existing institutions, both on educational pathways and labor market policies and the school's training system, strengthening these links will increase the progressive wage policy's effectiveness and streamline its implementation going forward, right? So I think we outline a couple things. And one thing is that the ability, like you said, the ability of the progressive wage policy to meet its goals will depend on the efficacy of our current skills training ecosystem. And we do have a skills training ecosystem, right? For example, all the efforts under the Human Resource Development Fund are currently HRD Corp. Those have existed for a while. So there are issues within that currently, but they do exist. So currently a large gap exists between workers' demands for skills and how many people actually receive them. This highlights an opportunity for the progressive wage model to bridge this gap by incentivizing employers to offer greater support in the sort of training and development aspects, right? But there are weaknesses regarding, spatially the availability of training providers across different states. There are issues where the current levy system and the skills courses available currently fall short of expectations of employers, and this is all highlighted using HRD Corp data. So we think that there's a few things that could happen. One of it is, like Kevin mentioned, the skill progression pathway or the skills ladder is important, right? And it's something that is still yet to be seen what it actually looks like for the Malaysian context. So HRD Corp already has all of this knowledge, all this data on what employers demand for skills are, what sectors demand what skills, what courses are available for each career and occupation. So we think that policymakers should leverage a lot of the HRD Corp's existing data and expertise to sort of look at the sector-specific skill requirements. And then through that, we can outline a more well-defined skill and career progression pathways similar to the Singapore context for each specific occupation. And that should also align with the salary increase guidelines that the white paper mentions, right? So in that way, we ensure that each wage increase is aligned with appropriate skills statement for each specific level. And then that could also, later on, there's so many other ways to integrate that with existing HRD Corp initiatives, like the micro-credential initiative. We've heard about that for a while, and so on and so forth. And on the other side, which is the education side, I guess the link that we hope to see is a greater integration with things like the existing TVET or technical and vocational education and training pathways. Great integration with the stuff like academy industry. I think that's been talked about quite a bit in the economy ministry, and all these other alternative higher education pathways. So I think closer integration with these educational pathways and the progressive wage policy will definitely be a good thing.
I think a lot of the focus now is about what the government can do when these people graduate. There's this, in fact, even during COVID, there's been this retraining program for workers who are unemployed but out of university. But shouldn't we move upstream to even tackle at higher education sectors before they even graduate? Like, why are there so many courses that are offered? Because even though there's a lack of demand, should we like reduce the number of courses, reframe the courses before even you have this problem, when people are unemployed, yet they graduate university? So one thing that has been, I'm not saying that the success is still debatable, but one thing they try in Singapore is this industry transformation roadmap, basically getting the government, the employers, and the higher education university in kind of a tripartite system to see what are the skills in demand for the next 10 to 20 years for the industry, and for the government to ask the higher education or skills provider to provide more of these courses. So I think there's a lot more greater integration required, and really to move the problem tackling at the upstream level rather than to wait until they are finish university and then trying to solve the problem.
So I think everybody should definitely take a dive into this paper that Kelvin and Kevin produced, right? Because it's really insightful. I will insert all the links in the podcast notes. And as the government gears up to kick off the pilot phase of the progressive wage model, what are key things that the government should keep in mind as far as design and implementation go, what are your key recommendations for the Malaysian government?
So I think we outlined that it's important to have a more gradual and phased transition towards changing a lot of the policy design aspects to increase the impacts, right? So for example, we outlined a more phased transition approach to both moving from voluntary approach to a mandatory compliance system. And we also outlined a sort of gradual roadmap towards increasing inclusivity, or rather increasing the coverage of the types of workers and the types of firms that are included in this policy. So I think part of that is understanding that we need to take this on a step-by-step basis, right? And there are important trade-offs. We understand that. We understand there are important trade-offs for in terms of administrative capacity and fiscal costs to the government. We understand that there's also large compliance costs and administrative burdens for the firms themselves. So that's why we stress that this is a good policy and what Malaysia needs now. But there are important policy design decisions that will have very large impacts on the overall effectiveness and success of this policy.
Kevin, any closing thoughts or recommendations for the Malaysian government?
Malaysia might be in a better spot than many other countries, but we know that especially in developed countries, you know, we saw the latest news, China economy has been slowest in the last 30, 40 years. Even 5% is not really achievable. This year, UK economy is in recessions. US economy is also depending on what's the interest rate, whether there's interest rates cuts, but if interest rate maintain the current amount, you know, that might affect US, which will affect Malaysia's economic growth coming up. So I think a lot of what Malaysia can do in terms of trying to push up income growth is also dependent on wider global context. And at the moment, there seems to be a lot more downside risk compared to upside risk in terms of global economy. And this might actually impact Malaysia's ability to raise wages. Because Malaysia has been doing somewhat better ever since the pandemic compared to whatever countries I mentioned. But how much can this be sustained if there's a declining global appetite, for example, in manufacturing, in terms of supply chain, especially with declining consumption in the Western country? This would also have an impact on Malaysia. So I think what has been is that Malaysia has been trying to really leverage on this supply chain disruption between US and China in order to bring some of this manufacturing activities to Malaysia. Be it semiconductors, be it, I think Anwar mentioned that Kedah has a big upcoming investment coming up. Right. So the thing is that perhaps Malaysia can really utilize some of these key, growth spots because there's a need for global friendshoring or reshoring, whatever you call that. And to start first from these sectors where there is a global demand away from China into Southeast Asia, especially for manufacturing, and Malaysia probably can start from this specific sectors in terms of increasing wages, which for progressive wage, and maybe from there to move something forward.
Kevin, Kelvin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Kevin Zhang and Kelvin Cheng, public policy researchers. This conversation is also available as a podcast. You can look up Beyond the Ballot Box on Spotify, the BFM app, or wherever we get your podcasts from. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.